Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We are back in the Billy Meyer case, and I'm going to focus on Contact Report 136 this evening, but I kind of want to weave it into some of the major points in the case and also listen to some clips that talk about reincarnation again. Billy's spiritual experiences started out when he was a very, very young child. And he was laying in his bed one evening in Bulach, Switzerland. This was a warm May evening. And he just woke up at 3 a.m. and he crawled out a lower window there in his bedroom and sat down on a bench outside and looked up at this beautiful starry sky. And he heard his own voice say, "Since ancient times, I've lived among the stars." And he could see the lights coming from the stars, but he sensed the radiating love of creation. As a very, very young boy, he had this kind of profound spiritual awakening this one evening. His contacts started shortly after that. He, when he was 5 years old, he started to get these telepathic messages and these mental visions from this elderly extraterrestrial human man named Spock. And young Billy told the pastor in Bulach about that, Pastor Zimmerman. Pastor Zimmerman encouraged him to pay attention to these telepathic messages. So one day, Billy was told to go out and play in the forest and wait. And he did just that at 5 years old. And he was out there in the forest looking down at some fish swimming in a stream. And then out of the sky came a silvery pear-shaped craft. It either hovered a few inches above the ground or landed there in the field. Out stepped Spoth, who was an extraterrestrial human, over 1,000 years old. He had kind of a diver's suit on. And Billy recognized Spoth's face from these mental images he was getting and recognized his voice. And so he followed him back up into the ship. And Spoth took Billy high above the earth, maybe some 70,000 meters above the Earth, which I think is kind of interesting because it gave Billy another perspective on things. It allowed him to see the bigger picture, which is really an amazing thing for a young boy of 5 years old to do. In some ways, I think that's what the Meyer material in general allows you to do, is see a bigger picture and get a bigger perspective. So here is Billy, this young boy, he's only 5 years old, and he's looking around in this ship, and he sees what looks like portholes all over. Well, they're actually viewing screens, and he can see people on each one of these viewing screens. But he realizes that he's far, far above the Earth. And Thoth starts to tell him about his past lives and his predecessor personalities. And Billy is told that his spirit, his human spirit, has reincarnated on the Earth more than 7 times, but the 7 most important reincarnations of Billy are Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. Now, the Meyer material refers to these names a little differently than we do today. There was actually, in fact, 3 Henochs or Enochs, but the primary one is Henoch from 9308 BC, who wrote the Henoch prophecies, which we'll talk about a little later. But Thoth explained to Billy that he had a mission here on the earth and that he would be a teacher and a prophet, and he would teach this ancient universal teaching that came to the earth hundreds of thousands of years ago when these extraterrestrial humans called the Lyrians were here initially, some 389,000 years ago initially. And Billy was a young boy, but he had a tremendous mental capacity. And Thoth was about to use some technology to expand his mental ability. So he placed on Billy's head this device that tapped into Billy's predecessor personalities. It kind of opened up the wisdom in his subconscious at a very, very young age. You see, the extraterrestrials know the human spirit of Edward Albert Meyer by the name Nocodemian. And Nocodemian is said to have led his people from the depths of the known universe into the oldest space and time-shifted regions of Lyra Vega. Nocodemian is said to be a creation of the planet Sadar, which was in what they call the Warren star system, which, I mean, I don't know anything about. It's some 3,816,000,000 light years from the solar system. So his spirit has been around for a long, long, long time, and he's been doing this kind of thing in previous lives on other worlds. And here on the earth, he's taught the teaching of the spirit, which consists of at least 5 areas that I've outlined, which is the universal consciousness, the human spirit, reincarnation, learning to control our thinking, learning personal responsibility. Maybe a 6th area, as you could say, maybe prophecy, is another aspect of the teaching of the spirit. So Billy has had these past lives where he's been a teacher. Now he's a 77-year-old farmer now. He lives in a tiny mountain village called Hinterschmidruti. It's about an hour outside of Zurich. He's a very quiet, kind of humble man. But if you read his writings, you'll find a tremendous amount of wisdom there. And Thoth was Billy's first extraterrestrial teacher. Thoth was about 1,000 years old. Thoth is the grandfather of Semyase, who is Billy's probably most well-known contact, which Billy started to meet with Semyase around the mid-70s. Semyase's father is Ptah. Ptah is another extraterrestrial human. He is supposedly the commander of the Plaiaran mothership. He is what they call an Ishwish, or a king of wisdom. Now, people that are kings of wisdom not only have tremendous amounts of knowledge, but they have tremendous, what we would call supernatural abilities, but really are just normal abilities that humans get when they get to this stage of creational wisdom. So here we are. I'm kind of reviewing this whole concept of predecessor personalities and reviewing Billy's initial contacts with Thoth. And this is where Billy started to learn about his previous lives, what his purpose here on the earth was. He was told that he would have a difficult life, that people would try to kill him, that his own wife would turn against him. He was told to stay in the background to focus on his writings, and that other people would come out and start to tell his story. I have some clips here that talk about reincarnation. I don't know which one of these I want to play first. I think I'll play this one here. And then we'll get back into the human spirit and some of the other aspects of reincarnation that are important.
The end of life, or the cue for a new beginning? Millions believe in reincarnation. Is there proof it really happens? Do people pass through many lifetimes, and can they bring back memories of having lived before? It's 350 years since the bloody battles of the English Civil War. But this man says he remembers fighting in them. And therapy has now encouraged people to relive the violent moments of their death in previous lives. But what can be known for certain? Scientists are trying to assess the evidence from those who claim to have lived before. Will they prove the case for reincarnation and reveal what brings those memories to the human mind? Many religions believe in reincarnation, but for most people raised as Christians, it's not something they expect. So when memories of past lives hit them, it can come as an unwelcome surprise.
I had never heard of something like this. I never was a believer in reincarnation, etc. I mean, it's not something I'm too pleased with. I really don't. I mean, I'm enjoying my life, but do I want to keep coming back and back? I don't know about that.
For Patricia Austrian, the agony of World War I's trench warfare and muddy battlefields belonged only in the history books, until her four-year-old son told her that he'd been there in a previous life. From the start, Patricia had been puzzled by her youngest son Edward's bizarre phobia.
Ever since he was 1 year old, he was really fearful of dark, gray, drizzly, damp days. He was very anxiety-ridden and would become quite clingy and whiny.
He was also constantly ill and used a strange name for the throat problems which plagued him.
He kept referring to this area of his throat as my shot. I thought that he was describing the hurt in his throat because he had tonsillitis. severely, always. He was always very sick.
But then Edward's parents were horrified to discover he had a growth in his throat, a severe type of cyst.
It was pretty big, very noticeable. It looked like a swelling in his throat.
Edward's doctors decided to remove his tonsils in preparation for further surgery. That night, after his operation, he suddenly told his mother a graphic first-hand account of a soldier's death in the trenches.
My name was James. I was 18 years old in France. Now remember, this is a 4-year-old child. We were walking along through the mud. It was damp. It was raining. It was cold. My rifle is heavy. I remember looking out and seeing fields of trees, and then there was desolation. I heard a shot come from behind, and it went through someone else, hit me square in the back of the neck, and I felt my throat fill with blood. Believe me, that sent a chill through me.
It seemed that Patricia's son had just told her of a violent death in a previous life, in more detail than a 4-year-old should have known.
So these are the kinds of stories that children often tell. Sometimes these memories from past lives come across. They're really, at our stage of evolution, according to Meyer material, they're not supposed to. What happens is our human spirit comes out of our physical body at death. Now, our human spirit is located in the midbrain. It's about the size of the end of a needle. It enlivens every cell in the body. And your human spirit never dies. It's completely invulnerable. It cannot be hurt by anything in the material world. It's the part of you that lasts more than one life. Now, when you die, your human spirit comes out of your body. And it goes into the spiritual realm or the fine matter world, which is in the same space that we live in the 3D world, but in another dimension. Now, the universal consciousness will take your past life memories and store them in the storage banks. Typically, we spend about between 115 and 152 years in the spirit realm. The human spirit does, about a lifetime and a half. And then the universal consciousness will take your human spirit and place it in the embryo of a child 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg. And that human spirit will go throughout that body, and it will animate every cell in that body. And consciousness evolution starts in the child. You'll get a new conscious, a new personality, and something called the consciousness block comes down from the spiritual realm, and it places the memories, the wisdom of your predecessor personalities in your subconscious. Now, your material conscious mind is still a total child, doesn't know anything. But as you grow up again, your material consciousness will get inspiration from your previous personalities and impulses from the storage banks. So you'll have an increased awareness from that previous life experiences. And that in that way, wisdom builds on wisdom in each lifetime. So your personality exists in your frontal lobe. Every time you reincarnate, you get a new personality. The memories from your previous life are stored in your subconscious, and you've got to grow back up again. And this process is repeated lifetime after lifetime, millions and millions of years. We reincarnate, and there's 7 evolutionary steps to human societies, and we'll go over that again. I wanted to remind you again of a few things that Semyase told Billy about the human spirit. Now, we talked about Svath, who met with Billy for the first, well, from Billy's being 5 years old to about 16. He met with Svath, and then for the next 11 years after that, he met with Asket, a woman from the Tao universe. Then he had 11 years of no contacts. And then right around 1975, he picked up his contacts with Semyase. Semyase was the granddaughter of Svath, who by this time had passed on. Semyase would land her ship there in the beginning in Schmidruti, Switzerland, on the hillsides or in the valleys, out in the open during the day. Billy would ride his moped out near the contact site. She would step out of her craft and walk over physically to him. And they would sit under the tree there, and she would have these wonderful discussions with Billy. And she would say things like, love and wisdom go together, and the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. She also said that every human has within them a spirit that doesn't die, that doesn't sleep during our deepest sleep. It records all of our actions and our thoughts, and it will tell us if our thinking is right or wrong if we have learned to pay attention to it. She said the human spirit is the seat of the infinite, but few are aware of that, and that it takes freedom from unreal teaching and sound logic to start waking up the human spirit, because the whole purpose of our lives is gathering knowledge and spiritual evolution. Now, Semyase also told him that our ancient philosophers even knew this, that everything is within the human, and that the human is the microcosm within the macrocosm. And that means we see these repeating patterns in nature. We see the branching pattern of our circulatory system and the branches of trees and other plants. We see the spiraling arms of the galaxy. Our DNA spirals. Shells grow in a spiral. We have electrons rotating around the nucleus of the molecules in our body. We have planets that rotate around stars, solar systems that rotate around galaxies, galaxies that spin, galaxies that have these big spiral arms. We see all of these repeating patterns in nature because all of nature is linked together. And Svath said that everything in the universe is one, and it's all bound together. And see, we live in a tightly woven, indissoluble web of life. And the creator of this indissoluble web of life is a universal consciousness. It's a neutral positive spirit. It builds universes as a part of its own evolution. And there are billions and billions of universes. We here in the Dern universe have a sister universe called the Tao universe. Both of them are 46 trillion years old. Now, if you could cut open our universe, it would have concentric rings or layers of spiritual energy. There's only one layer, one ring that has material in it. It has planets and solar systems and galaxies. And what happens is energy moves into the material belt and becomes matter for about 45 billion years. And then it turns back in energy. So our scientists think that our universe is only about 45 billion years old, but it's much older. Now, there is a universal consciousness that exists in our universe. And our scientists are starting to figure this out. And it's not God, because our religious notion of God is not the scientific reality. You see, we're kind of... Semyonsky said that love and wisdom go together, and that the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. But we're really responsible for ourselves here. And adhering to these principles associated with life. Let me play this. This is a man named Brendan Hughes, a scientist. There's a little dead air here at the beginning, but I think he has a really great presentation, on the universal consciousness here, and he comes on here shortly. It very similar.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to speak on the emergence of universal consciousness. Now, admittedly, that's a controversial topic. And it's a controversial topic because so far, universal consciousness has not been scientifically proven to be true. But this conception that things need to be scientifically proven in order for them to be true is itself false. And that's neatly demonstrated each and every time scientists discover something new, something that we didn't know before. Most recently, scientists are finding evidence for the Higgs boson. But if it's true that it exists, then it means it's existed for millions and millions of years. It's always been true. So I think the way to play a game of philosophical chess is to try and start with just one sentence that we can maybe agree upon, and then see if we can take it forward one step at a time until the next sentence just seems too improbable or too outlandish, and that's really where we should stop. By the end of this talk, you might agree or disagree with everything I say, and that's fine. If you should find yourself coming to agree for the first time that some of these concepts are possibly true, then that could change the way you possibly think about many things. So I'd like to start with a simple proposition and one that is credited to Aristotle. The whole is something greater than the sum of its parts. Or put another way, everything that exists exists both as a whole unto itself as well as a component of some greater holistic system. Now there's a lot of evidence for this proposition. For example, we know that electrons are individually charged particles. But we also know that electrons are components of atoms. Atoms are components of molecules. Molecules are components of organisms. Organisms arise within systems and ecosystems. Ecosystems are located on planets. Planets are components of solar systems. And solar systems are components of galaxies, and galaxies components of universes. So it does seem that everything that exists both as a whole unto itself and as a component within a greater whole. Now, if that's true, then it suggests that your true holistic identity consists of both your narrow self-identity and your component identity within a greater system. And if you can come to accept that it is your narrow self-identity that is endowed with your self-consciousness, then you can at least begin to question whether the holistic system of which you're a component has holistic consciousness. And we'll come back to that question in a minute. But we need to start by discussing what we mean by consciousness. There's no uniform scientifically accepted definition of the term consciousness. I think consciousness means the ability to sense or to respond to what you sense in your environment, whether it's your internal or your external environment. That's what I think consciousness is. Imagine this example. You wake up a little bit late one morning, and you decide to skip breakfast. You're on your way to a meeting, and you're walking down the street, and you smell some freshly baked croissants coming from a nearby bakery. The smell triggers a chemical response in your brain, which stimulates your appetite. You turn, you walk into the bakery, and you order a croissant. So what about plants? Well, when plants experience their environment, why don't we call it consciousness? We know that leaves will turn to face the sun to absorb its energy. We know that an entire field of sunflowers will all face east in the morning when the sun rises and they detect the sun's rays. They will then track the sun across the sky throughout the day and then all face west at sunset. We know that plants' roots will penetrate the earth and then extend in various angles as they seek out water. But we don't call this consciousness. I think consciousness is an attribute. It's not a measure of one's ability. It is something that you either have or you don't have, and you can have it in different measures. So with plants, why don't we call this consciousness? We call it things like holotropism. And we tend to say with plants it's not consciousness because it's fundamentally a chemical process. It's not consciousness. But neurobiologists are telling us that our own brains are fundamentally super chemical computers, and that our own decisions, the actions we take, and indeed our entire state of consciousness at any particular time, is fundamentally influenced by chemical processes in the brain and the chemical balance in our brain at any particular time. So I think not calling non-human things conscious is a weak distinction to make, and frankly, egotistical. We need to get over ourselves in that way. Surely any living thing that can experience its environment and that can respond to what it senses in its environment is conscious, but conscious in a way that makes sense to that thing, makes sense to its ability to sustain its own life. What about even really, really small things, like bacteria? Well, we know that inside your own human gastrointestinal tract, there are up to 1,000 different species of bacteria. And over the last 20 years, scientists have been discovering ways in which bacteria can signal and communicate with each other to coordinate community processes, ranging from maintenance of their population to resisting or aiding an infectious disease. But if these bacteria are signaling and communicating, then they too are conscious. And then this is where it gets really interesting. If those bacteria are living inside us and we are their environment, then we are their conscious environment too. They live inside a conscious environment, even though they could never know it. They're not aware of our higher holistic consciousness. What about things that we don't typically regard as living things? Things I've mentioned already, like electrons that orbit an atomic nucleus, or planets that orbit a sun. Well, we know that electrons are negatively charged particles that seem to orbit at relatively high speeds around a nucleus without ever crashing into each other. They don't crash into each other because two negatively charged atomic particles will magnetically detect and repel from each other when they get too close. If you're an electron, it's not relevant to be able to smell a freshly baked croissant. Your world is about electromagnetism, so magnetically detecting other charges is what's relevant to an electron. What about planets in orbit? We know that planets also occupy specific orbital patterns around the sun and don't crash into each other. And yes, I do know that with planets, It's the attracting force of gravity that holds them in their orbital paths, and not the attracting force of electromagnetism, as in the case of electrons. But philosophically speaking, the similarities are striking across such vast scales and such different forces that are at play, and it tends to support the hypothesis of everything being part of a transcending, enveloping understanding of everything. There's no doubt that the smaller system occurs many, many times over within the larger system. Now, when you came to this event today, you hopefully didn't crash into anyone on the way. And that's because you used your senses to detect things that are physical in the way that you are and to avoid them. And hopefully everybody else was using their senses to do the same thing. But if you'd lost consciousness for a few moments, or if you'd simply been driving much too fast, it might have been unavoidable that you were going to collide with someone. And it's the same with subatomic particles. We can make them collide by accelerating their speeds to such an extent that it's impossible for them to avoid a collision. And that's what particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider do. They accelerate particles, they make them collide, and then scientists get to watch and observe what smaller components those particles break down into. So it seems that under certain conditions, a form's innate ability to respond to what's going on in its environment in a way that is appropriate to sustain itself is insufficient. And when that happens, whether as a sudden collision event or as a result of imbalances gradually accumulated over time, that form will begin to break down to its component states. Viewed this way, life and death are both processes. Life is the organization of energy into form, and death is the liberation of energy from form and the reduction of a form back to its component states. We know that to endure, any form first needs an awareness of its environment, internal and external, in order to compensate for the changes taking place. The tendency of a form to compensate for change can be observed across the vast range of natural phenomena, and it's evidenced by the interplay between the second law of thermodynamics and what we call self-organizing dissipative systems. The second law of thermodynamics holds that for every process of energy transfer in a system, there is an increase in entropy in the system. That means that for every random event that takes place, the disorder of the system will increase. In other words, systems or forms need to be able to respond to this disorder in such a way that preserves their relative stability. Spiral shapes, such as can be seen on a number of different things, from a simple hermit crab shell to the shape of the Milky Way or Andromeda galaxies, are examples of the complex patterns and structures that can emerge during a process of dissipation to retain stability over periods, in particular, of rapid expansion. Now, organisms are, by definition, organized. And if we can see the organized properties of even very large systems, then it's only really culture that stops us from referring to very large systems as organisms. I believe that consciousness will emerge wherever and whenever complex organizing systems and forms emerge. But it will be a consciousness of a type that is relevant to that complex system or form. If consciousness plays a role in ensuring survival, then we should begin to question what role does consciousness play in the process of evolution. Darwin argued that seemingly random genetic mutations that took place in genetic codes resulted in beneficial adaptations that thrived. But there is growing evidence to support the view that genetic mutations are environmentally responsive. For example, experiments by scientists such as Barry Hall have observed that the genetic rate of mutation in bacteria increases under environmentally stressful conditions. So, if genetic mutation is environmentally responsive, then it's not a very distinct process from what we regard as innovation. Because in both processes, it is the processing and feedback of information that results in the formation of something new. Enter social media and wearable tech, something we should expect to arise if the promotion of information networks in a system is going to enhance the ability of a system to communicate across different components of itself. Your social media stream might eventually evolve to become your externalized stream of consciousness that you choose to share with other people. This belief that we are all part of one thing is perfectly encapsulated by the Zulu word simunye, which means we are one. And this simunye hypothesis is one that is as old as philosophy. It suggests that humans should understand ourselves within this organism to be semi-autonomous, conscious measuring agents of a complex adaptive system that is constantly adjusting and responding and adapting. If the universe itself is, as science might ultimately prove, a complex dissipative system, then not only would the universe have consciousness, but that consciousness would be as old as time, and it would envelop all other forms of consciousness within it, including yours and mine. Thank you.
That was a very, very long clip, and I do apologize for playing the whole thing. I enjoy that fellow very much. I think his name is Brendan Hughes. I think he's got really close to defining the universal consciousness as taught by the Meyer material, which I was very encouraged to hear a scientist say that, to say these things. I wanted to get back to another way of looking at this universal consciousness. Billy, in one of his writings, it's called, I think, Love Letter 27, says that the incredible splendor of nature is nothing more than the visible expression of the love of creation, and that creation radiates love, so that at every place, every day, every moment, we can sense the radiating love of creation. We should be able to look at a tree and be reminded of the radiating love of creation. You see, creation radiates love. And nothing would exist that does exist if it were not for the radiating love of creation. Every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in creation. Only mankind, with his consciousness, can shut himself down from the radiating love of creation. Now, in the Goblet of Truth, there's this wonderful paragraph that for me sums up how the universal consciousness works in all things. There's a paragraph, it's entitled, What the Truth Knows to Say. And it states that rivers, lakes, trees, stones, bushes, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time which involve many, many lifetimes. And that death is just the passage to rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures are connected by psychic vibrations, and they're aware of each other, and they communicate with one another. And they're all part of this tightly woven, indissoluble web of life where no creature tries to rise up above those of its own kind. So I always recommend people go into the forest. And I, again, took time today to go into the forest and observe the plants, observe how they grow, observe how they're all interlinked. Listen to the sounds of the forest, the cicadas, the birds, the peepers, the frogs. There's this beautiful cacophony of sound that comes from creation. Watch the birds. Now we're getting into fall and they're preparing to fly south. Watch the way they move from tree to tree as a unit. You know, 20 of them will just move to the next tree all at once and fly and land simultaneously as if they're connected. They're aware of each other. Same with fish. If you look at fish in a stream, they do the same thing. They move in unison. So we're all connected. We're all part of this larger whole, this universal consciousness. Now, the universal consciousness is not God. As it says in the book of OM, Omphale and Marado, the gods of the earth were human. They came from the depths of space. They came from foreign worlds, different star systems, and they unrightfully set themselves up above the earth humans. And they demanded worship. And after a while, they left or they died off. But they were not the universal consciousness. They didn't create all things. They hadn't been here for all eternity. But our ancestors didn't know any better. They were so impressed by these people with these higher consciousness abilities and higher technologies that they unrightfully worshiped them. Now, what has happened over hundreds of years is these concepts have kind of got merged. So now we have this notion of this anthropomorphic God, this human-like God that's angry and jealous and gets involved in human wars. And the Meyer material says the universal consciousness, it doesn't work that way. It radiates love and it has great wisdom, but it doesn't. If you don't take your garbage out, it doesn't come down here and take your garbage out for you. So anyway, I think we've been kind of confused by our religions over time. And there were groups here on the earth, and Ask It, and I've talked about this many times, but Ask It took Billy far below the Giza Plateau into these old cubicle constructions that are some 72,000 years old. And Billy saw this great hallway with this ancient spacecraft in there. And he saw the headquarters of the Giza intelligences. And Askett later told him that these Giza intelligences have used religion to confuse the people of the world. So they posed as gods and angels and demons, and at various times during Earth history, they've manipulated the people of the Earth. They work with the Thule Society in Germany and with Hitler. They had a technology. They had something called telenotic impulses, which would affect our minds and still affect our minds, even though the Giza intelligences have been pushed off the earth. These telenotic impulses still affect the people of the earth. The Giza intelligences really came here following about 11,500 BC, when after the great meteor hit the earth, after the fall of Atlantis, that great cataclysm where there are just a few humans left here that were climbing out of the rubble of this destruction. And eventually civilization started to reestablish itself on the earth after this great disaster. But these people, you know, after many generations, there were no historical records. They lost their technology. They forgot their history. But once again, these people from the stars came, and I think it was Eris the 11th who had a son, Erisame, and Erisame eventually killed Eris the 11th. Erisame was in power for 700 years, and he had a son, I believe, called Jehave, which eventually killed him. Jehave was also in power for centuries, and then Jehave had a son named Jehovan. Jehovan was in power for centuries. Anyway, this is the long line of the Giza intelligence. That's my understanding. And it goes down through a man named Hen, who was called Jehovah at times, and then Kamigal the First and Kamigal the Second. So right around 1970, the Giza intelligences were pushed off the earth by the Pleiaren. And it just dawned on me that I hadn't really, once again, defined the Pleiaren, in case there are some new listeners that will listen to this archive. Most of the world knows Billy's contacts as the Pleiadians, but in 1995 they revealed their true identity. They're not from our Pleiades. They reside some 80 light years beyond our Pleiades in a different space-time configuration. They live in the Pleiades star system. They call themselves the Pleiaren. Their ancestors came to their solar system about 250,000 years ago, and under the leadership of an Ishwish named Asael, who was Illyrian. And over hundreds of thousands of years, they eventually developed into the high level of evolvement they are now. They live on a planet very similar to the Earth, much higher oxygen content. They don't have roads. They don't use money. They don't have war. They don't have disease. They do not do manufacturing on their own planet. They manufacture things off-world. They don't drive on the surface of their planet. There's no need for roads. They have craft that they can fly from one area to another. They only work about 2 hours a day. The rest of the time is focused on what they're interested in. It's focused on spiritual growth. They have very strict laws in some way in terms of spirituality. They live in union with each other and with nature. And they don't, there's no pollution. They don't pollute their water. They don't pollute their air. They keep their population low. They keep their planet in a very, very pristine state. And it's taken them many, many, many years to evolve to this level. They had bases here on the Earth during the main contact period, which was between 1975 and 1986, for about 11 years. The Pleiaren and the Timmers and people from other star systems resided in bases in Asia, in North America, and in Switzerland. The bases in Switzerland have been here for 350 years. In 1995, they left. Tell us why. My understanding is there are still one extraterrestrial human group here. They live within Mount Shasta. They're called the Hyperboreans. They're a blonde people, fair-skinned people. Their spherical colored golden spacecraft are sometimes seen coming out of the eastern side of Mount Shasta. They've been here for
hundreds of thousands of years. They also have bases beneath the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. Sometimes they'll use these beams that they have to paralyze Earth humans that get too close. They're nothing damaging, permanently damaging, or anything like that. The Hyperboreans choose to live separate from these people, but they are also extraterrestrial humans. And our history is really the history of extraterrestrial humans that came to the Earth. Our origins are from Lyra Vega, from the Sirius system, from Mars, from Melona. The Oriental people here came here from a planet on the other side of the central sun of our galaxy. And I'll have to look at my notes again. The name has left me for some reason. But we're a melting pot here on the Earth. That's why we have these very, very ancient structures. And we don't understand how they were built. They were built by humans that had higher technology than us, that had higher spiritual understanding. Great Pyramid of Giza, Puma Punku, the statues of the Colossi of Memnon in Egypt, Machu Picchu, Stonehenge, many, many of these ancient megalithic structures were designed by humans who had a much higher consciousness than us, who were much taller than us, who had greater technologies than we do. Now, we are in the time of the third millennium, and the Meyer material says this is the make-or-break time. We'll either become a society that destroys itself or a society that moves on to the next level and lives in peace and harmony and has a successful life. I'm going to take a break. We're going to play a little music. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. I'll be right back. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Before we went on break, I was talking about origins of Earth humans, and I kind of glazed over the Chinese and Japanese races, which are said to be the youngest inhabitants of planet Earth. The two yellow races lived on the other side of the Milky Way. They lived on the other side of the central sun of our galaxy in a planet called Kudra that was in the Nizan system. The Chinese people, the Mayan, calls the Kintan, and the Mayan material calls the Japanese the Nipa people. And they were said to be discovered by a group from the Lyrian system 16 million years ago. And the people from Lyra brought some of these people back to Lazon. Planet Kudra was said to be discovered by an expedition fleet from Lazon. These are people from Lyra Vega. When they left the Lyra system approximately 6 million years ago, they conducted research for human life on the galaxy. Records, they climb out of the rubble, they repeat the process all over again. So one of the hopes of the Pleiaren is to keep us from destroying ourselves again, once again, as we have done over and over again. Now, I think I have another clip somewhere, and when you get too many clips, this becomes a bit of a problem because you're trying to find the next clip, and sometimes they get out of order. But again, this is on reincarnation. I won't play this whole clip. It's about children remembering past lives. I think you'll find this interesting.
In the country town of Hexham.
It was there one Sunday morning that tragedy struck John Pollock and his family. His two daughters and a friend were killed by a car on their way to church. Jacqueline was 6 and Joanna 11 when they died, but John Pollock did not despair while Hexham grieved. He believed that his wife would conceive twins, that the girls would be reborn.
From the moment I knew she was pregnant, I believed that the girls would come back.
And against all the doctor's predictions, Florence Pollock did produce twin girls.
The first thing I noticed when I saw those twins was, we haven't named them then, but the younger one of the two had a scar coming across her forehead down onto the bridge of her nose, which was the identical scar that Jacqueline, the younger one of the girls that had been killed, had when she fell off a little tricycle when she was about 2 years old. Also, I didn't see at the time, but later, my wife said to me, it's an incredible thing, that she's also got the birthmark on her left hip that Jacqueline had. Jacqueline had a birthmark on her left hip which was like a brown thumbprint.
To this day, Jennifer still has that brown birthmark. Mrs. Pollock was astonished when she gave the twins the dead girl's dolls.
When I got these two dolls out, one said, oh, that's Mary, and that's Susan. And it was exactly the same names as my other daughters had named them. And that was the sort of really turning point in my way of thinking.
The family had moved away after the tragedy, but on their first visit to Hexham, the twins seemed to remember the landmarks.
Well, when we came at the top of Battle Hill, they came over the brow, approaching St. Mary's Church, which they couldn't see. One turned to the other and said, well, the school's around here, which we used to go to, and the playground's round the back. Now, they couldn't possibly have seen any sign of a school or a church even. I mean, they were so small, they couldn't even have seen over the wall. And sure enough, I mean, the school is round the corner. And this was the most incredible thing. And we continued to walk on. I mean, we were absolutely amazed at this. And as we came past the church, on the opposite side of the road is Hexham Abbey and the Abbey grounds. And one turned and said, oh, the playground's over there.
And she was right. The playground was over there. But they couldn't see it from where they were standing because the brow of the hill was in the way. So convinced were the Pollocks that their daughters had been reborn that even the children's grave no longer held any sorrow for them.
There's a grave there, but it means nothing. To me, to bring flowers or anything on the grave would be sheer hypocrisy, because I don't believe that they're here. I mean, it's just a symbol of two girls that lived that were reborn.
Symbol of two girls that lived and were born. There's need to fear death. We've died before. We're going to die again, and we'll be back. I'll be back. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger said that. Your human spirit will be back. Your human spirit is about the size of the head of a pin. Its energy animates every cell in your body. Your human spirit is located in what's called the superior colliculus, in the midbrain, in the area that is associated with sight and the movement of your eyes and things like that. Now, when the human spirit comes into the body of an embryo, consciousness evolution starts. And as we talked about earlier, the wisdom of the predecessor personalities is placed into the subconscious. A new consciousness is created, and we get our inspiration from the subconscious as we grow up and mature again, and we get impulses from the storage banks. So in this world, wisdom is built upon the meaning of time. Now, the spirit is the creation of the universal consciousness to help it evolve to the next level. Review these ideas of reincarnation, the idea of the human spirit, to once again focus on the different aspects of the Meyer teaching. One thing that we haven't discussed in a while is a part of your spirit body called the Gemut, which controls your the thinking and feelings associated with your human spirit. Now, it has a counterpart called the psyche, and the psyche controls the thinking and feeling with your material consciousness. There are two sides. They're completely different, but they have a similar function. Your Gemut supplies the psyche with these psychic swinging waves that the Meyer material talks about. It's an electromagnetic energy. And the power, the impetus of your thoughts, the power of your thoughts comes streaming in from the universe. And that's why our thoughts are so incredibly powerful. Now, unfortunately, we are a humankind that's ill in its consciousness. And Elizabeth Moosberger wrote the foreword to the Might of Thoughts book by Billy Meyer. And she says that this book, which lies before you, is dedicated to a humankind that is ill in its consciousness, so that it finds again the creational natural way which it lost so long ago. There's a German term called Assartung, which means to get very badly out of control of the good nature. Thoughts that are too positive or too negative can lead to Assartung. Only neutral positive thinking can repair our psyche. Now, I want to repeat that, because when your thoughts get too far out of balance in either a positive or a negative way, you damage your psyche. But this neutral positive thinking can repair your psyche. And the Might of Thinking is every human being's key to his personal power in all things. The human being has to learn to stop doing things which he does not want to do. I mean, a lot of times we're ruled by compulsion and we do things and we don't know why. We also nurture wish dreams, which is actually a healthy thing to do. Now, there is an analogy between a garden and your consciousness. And even since ancient times, the saying has prevailed that those who make effort will harvest a result. And Billy states that we must make an effort to clarify our thoughts. So when you clarify your thoughts, they become more valuable and more productive. For me, the clarification of my thoughts comes when I go back over things again and again. Clarification means the action of making things less confused and more comprehensible. We should practice clarifying our thoughts. Go over things and clarify our thoughts. Now, just a physical garden grow plants. You can plant seeds and get plants. And weeds. Because once your thoughts are animated and created, they develop their own life. Exactly like plants. And you can gather a harvest of sweet fruit, healthy plants, if you maintain your garden correctly. In the same way with your consciousness, you can have very productive thoughts if you maintain your consciousness. But if negative thoughts are allowed to grow in our consciousness, they will proliferate. Like wildly growing weeds, and they will displace everything. So, and that's what's happening, in a sense, in our society right now. Many of us, and we all have suffered from this at time to time, will get unbalanced in our thinking. And if those thoughts aren't pulled out by the roots, we can have these weeds which grow wildly. And the weeds of negative thinking lead to gifts. The trends we're going to see in the third millennium. And in Contact 6, one of the predictions that the IRL will make, John Lennon murdered. He will be murdered by a religiously misguided one named Chapman, who moreover suffers from delusional ideas caused by erroneous religious teachings as well, as this will appear more and more in the extreme with those who have succumbed to delusional religious cults and the sects in the United States. And I have a clip here where John Lennon talks about the Illuminati. And as this clip goes on, you'll probably get a clear understanding as I believe the elite set up John Chapman. He was their, I don't know what the word is, stool pigeon, or he was a pawn. Chapman was a pawn. John Lennon was a threat to the elite because he wanted to unite people in peace. Let's listen to what John Lennon had to say and why they ultimately had to kill him, or felt they had to kill him.
I think our society is run by insane people for insane objects, objectives. And I think that's what I sussed when I was 16 and 12, way down the line. But I expressed it differently all through my life. It's the same thing I'm expressing all the time. But now I can put it into that sentence that I think we're being run by maniacs for maniacal ends, you know. If anybody can put on paper what our government and the American government, etc., and the Russian, Chinese, what they are actually trying to do, you know, and how, what they think they're doing.
Mm.
I'd be very pleased to know what they think they're doing. I think they're all insane. You know, but I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's insane about it.
Yeah. Every country's had a violent revolution for one reason or the other. Not one of them has the freedom we're all talking about. So we're saying give peace a chance, you know, like nobody's ever done it before. And it's not a matter of, we're not thinking in terms of 10 years, we're thinking in terms of peace forever, you know. And everybody's talking about now, I want peace now, we can get peace now if we want it now. And the left wing talk about giving the power to the people. You know, anybody knows that the people have the power. All we have to do is awaken the power in the people. The people are unaware. It's like they're not educated to realize that they have power. They put the politicians in power. They vote for the local mayor. The people do it. But the system is so geared that everybody believes that just the father will fix everything. The father being the government. Government will fix everything. It is all government's fault. You know, shake your fist at the government. Well, we are the government. The people are the government, the people have the power, but we must try and make them aware of this.
And Yoko was telling me about this great old ancient Chinese book, which tells you how to fight the battle, you know. And it says the battle is always lost within the castle, you know, like America's falling within, not from within, from the commies coming.
Yeah.
It's falling apart inside. And this book on how to fight the good fight says that never have every door shut. The enemy then will...
Everybody's going to
come round and attack. But if you leave one door open, you know where they're going to come in, and then you get them. So intuitively, we're doing that. And we leave a door open. They're so busy shouting about haircuts and genitals and naked and long hair that they concentrate their ammunition there. We know where it comes from, and we get on with the job of selling and or doing whatever we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that. You leave the door open, man, and that's where the door they'll come in, you know.
As a beetle, we made it. And there was nothing to do. We had money, we had fame, and there was no joy. You know? And then I met Yoko, and she was making it as an avant-garde artist, and we both tried to find something we had in common, a common goal in life, because she couldn't rock and roll with me, and I couldn't avant-garde with her. I mean, we can, but that's what we thought at the time. So we decided the thing we had in common was love, and from love came peace. So we decided to work for world peace.
And how do you do that?
We do it by the advertising method. We believe that today's society, advertising is the thing politicians use and commercial companies use, the Beatles use it, John and Yoko should use it. Our product is peace.
Have less words and more peace. I think the only way to do it is Gandhi's way. And that's non-violent, passive, positive, or whatever they called it those days. You know. We're selling it like soap, you know. And you've got to sell and sell until the housewife thinks, oh, well, there's peace or war. That's the two products. Peace.
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 Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace. Peace.
Peace in your mind. Peace on earth. Peace at work. Peace at home. Peace in the world.
It's to try and get people orientated to think peace, like eat for peace, breathe for peace, and dance for peace, and make love for peace, you know, to just have...
So you can see why the elite didn't want to keep this guy around, because they like making their money with war, and that leads me into my next topic in Contact 136, which talks about Israel. And I've always wondered what the Meyer material thought about Israel, and... it kind of agrees with the quote-unquote conspiracy theorists. Now let me read line 103 to 104 from Contact 136. Especially now, it also confirms what has been said since ancient times, that the Israeli people originally never were an actual people, but that this mass of people in ancient times singly and alone consisted of a gigantic group of degenerate and partially even criminal elements who during their existence on earth at that time only incited discord, falseness, and war. Having come forth
from the ones who were expelled because they did not obey any order and were criminal. They assembled together in a mob in ancient times and formed the sham people of the Hebrons, they called them the gypsies, who in their megalomania and in their selfishness and egoism named themselves a chosen people who wanted to take up an elevated and ruling position over all terrestrial peoples, as indeed known to you. Well, so I guess it's true. The Meyer material says that Israel is behind much war and incited discord, and they want to put themselves in a ruling position over the people of the earth. Now, I'm going to play a little clip from the Arab-Israeli War from 1967.
June 5th, 1967, 7:45 a.m. Israel delivers a stunning opening blow in the Six-Day War. Within a few hours, the Israeli airstrike has devastated the Egyptian Air Force. Fighting on three different fronts against the combined might of three Arab armies, Israel would win a war in the space of just 6 days. How did this tiny nation achieve one of the most astonishing victories in the history of warfare? Eyewitness testimony, unique access to secret military plans, and weapons testing reveal the extraordinary story of how Israel won the Six-Day War. In early June 1967, tensions in the Middle East were rising. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser had called on the Arab nations to destroy Israel. War seemed inevitable. Israel faced the grim prospect of a simultaneous invasion from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The combined Arab armies had a massive superiority in numbers of soldiers, tanks, and fighter aircraft.
Israel is viewed not only by themselves, but by the rest of the world as a scrappy little nation on the very edge of survival.
The general mood in the Arab world was that Israel is not that strong. It could be defeated.
Yet against most expectations, the opposite happened. In less than a week, Israel had defeated its Arab neighbors. How was such a stunning victory achieved? Understand.
So according to Meyer material, the Israelis have a theory on the earth inside is called falseness and war. Originally came from the Egyptian people, the Hebrons, who were megalomaniacal, they were selfish, and they tried to make so certain people from Israel are causing many problems in our earth today. Let's pick back up on our clip.
To put all of their oomph against the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Syrians at the same time. They had to concentrate. The Israelis had to concentrate their force against one enemy at a time.
To fight a war the way it wanted, Israel would need to gain air superiority. Once the Arab air forces had been dealt with, Israel could fight each of their ground forces in turn. In 1964, Sadan's team came up with an unorthodox plan.
The idea that we came to was to strike their airstrips.
These classified plans have remained secret for 40 years. They reveal how Israel would achieve air superiority. The primary objective would be to keep the Arab air forces on the ground.
By disabling the runways of the Egyptian Air Force, and then the Syrian, etc., etc., you prevent the aircraft from taking off.
Targeting the runways would take hundreds of Arab aircraft out of the equation. The plan was good, in theory, But what were its chances of success?
We had a problem there. They had tens of runways, more than 50. We had only 206 aircraft.
The problem they faced is a scenario the Israeli Air Force trains for to this day. How could the IAF keep enough of their aircraft in the air to destroy all their targets?
NATO used to consider 3 missions per aircraft per 24 hours the maximum that can be done.
But was this really the limit of what could be achieved?
A bright staff officer in the Israeli Air Force was running some numbers one day and realized that the Israeli Air Force could turn around an aircraft after a mission in 6 to 8 minutes.
Everything would depend on how fast the ground crews could work.
They did so many exercises and drills to reload and refuel the aircraft that it took them up to 7 minutes.
If the ground crew worked to the limit, each aircraft...
Okay, we'll probably come back to that concept in the future. I'd like to do some more research on that. There's also some other little more minor issues. The Contact 136 talks about that I think are also important. But one big one, and this is in line 184 through 185, talks about the change of our climate. Another action with the coming climate, which will already be at hand in October, and which especially concerns the northern hemisphere of the Earth. I already explained to you earlier that in the specific, the whole Earth will slowly become a flood-prone area. However, the climate will also continue to change in such a way that icy cold weather will fall over regions of the Earth because the new cooling time inevitably approaches, whereby the overall view of the Earth once again. In the north, completely domesticated birds already begin annually to draw to the warmer south for the winter. And already in 100 years, these feathered animals will no longer have a home in the north. Today, many animals still living in the northern areas migrate, on the other hand, to the south, where they already begin to change themselves in their entire anatomy, etc., in order to adapt themselves to the new and approaching cold climate. Many kinds will begin to change themselves in another form, which will be determined soon by earthly scientists, whereby they can exist in this new climate. Thus, the picture of the animal world will at other times by boil. The earthman, being self to take cannot avoid the new change. The science of the United States.
11 degrees below zero right now in Chicago, and take a look behind me. You can see the vapor rising from Lake Michigan here. It's that cold. And overnight, we got new video showing just how cold it is here in the Midwest. Take a look.
Oh, God.
When it gets this cold, black ice is king.
They need to get somebody out here to stop this.
It's just one of the countless ways the frigid polar vortex is crippling more than half the nation.
If you can stay in today, stay in all day today.
School closings as far south as Atlanta. The streets in central Illinois completely deserted. The wind chill there, a mind-numbing negative 30 degrees. Try opening the window in Chicago and you'll get this. 35 below zero, right in your living room. It's so cold, Lake Michigan looks more like a hot tub. The water outside Chicago, warmer than the frigid air, and ice already forming along the banks.
This right here is just more than we expected at all.
So cold, many car batteries just aren't working.
With the cold weather, it's not going to start.
A water main break in sub-zero Columbus, Ohio, turning streets into steaming rivers. Crews scrambling to clean it up before it freezes solid. In southwest Michigan, lighthouses transforming into Arctic ice castles. And this fountain left running outside Minneapolis, now a mountain of ice. Overnight, a Chicago family trapped in their car for more than 15 hours.
We were calling for help, and it was no one there to help us.
On that same highway, ice road nightmare. Truckers everywhere praying they won't be next.
I'd freeze to death before I got help.
And in Indianapolis, in the middle of the snowstorm, a young mother giving birth to her first child by herself at home early Monday morning.
Her due date was not until the 21st. I think she wanted to see the blizzard. She didn't want to miss out.
Mom and baby are doing okay this morning. Great news there. Amazing story. Take a look at what happens when I spray some water here on this bus stop. Okay, I've been wanting to try this, but the water's been freezing inside the bottle first. I get this car scraper here, this ice scraper. You hear that? Instantly. This water turns right to ice, Robin.
We do hear that. All right, Gio, thank you.
Looks like I got a caller. Hi, Eve. How are you this evening?
I'm good, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. What did you think of Contact 136?
Oh, my gosh. There was so much information in there. This is what I was waiting for. I was waiting for... you know, a contact that he did, what, in 1980 and predicted all this stuff. I was amazed.
I know. It's really interesting, too. I mean, everything from the assassination of John Lennon, and then this whole Zionist trend, which I need to do a whole lot of more research on, the change in our climate. And there are other things in there with which I just kind of glossed over.
When was Reagan president? I can't remember.
Oh, that's a very good question.
Because they talk a lot about Reagan and how it really all started with Reagan.
Yeah, and we thought Reagan was really doing good, didn't we? We thought he was, you know, a great president. At least I did.
I didn't. I was in England at the time, and I was working in this little hotel, and that was when he became governor of California, and I worked as a waitress in this little hotel. Oh, my gosh, the English gave me so much trouble about an actor becoming governor, and
really?
I just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. Well, the reason why I am calling is you're having trouble with your sound, Mark.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're about every few minutes you're chopping up really bad and you're not understandable. And then about 45 seconds later you come back and then it goes again. So I'm not sure maybe you could check something there or...
Well, I'm glad you called and told me. Yeah, I'll definitely listen to the archive and really nothing's changed. So I don't know what... Other than a bad connection. It could just be a bad connection because I did, I just disconnected there and BTR called me back on Skype. So, you know, it could be a bad connection tonight. Well, I'm glad you told me.
Maybe that fixed it. So let's hope it is because you're on a really good roll and we were just screaming at you in chat.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. I know you don't watch chat.
Well, I do sometimes. Sometimes I don't. What did you think about the clip on universal consciousness? Could you hear that or was that breaking up?
No, that was good.
So it was only me?
No, that was good.
Okay, so it was just my Skype. Well, maybe I'll have to give Skype a rest for a while and go back to calling in on the phone, so... if that's more reliable. But I appreciate
anyway, Carrie.
Go ahead.
I just say, carry on. You're doing a good job. Just hope you don't cut out more.
Okay. Thanks, Eve.
All right. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, I appreciate Eve calling in and letting me know. I guess I'm sorry about that. I don't know if that'll be screwed up on the archive. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But that's pretty much... all I had this evening. If anybody else wanted to call in real quick, you could do that. The only other thing I might do is if I can find I have a view on the fires and how that's all coming along. I don't have any statistics. I think the happy campfire, they're calling it the happy campfire in Northern California, is causing some evacuations right now. So I'll play this clip and we'll probably end the show shortly after that.
Growth in one of the fires in the Happy Camp complex has forced the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office to issue mandatory evacuation notices.
Those notices were issued late last night. The areas under a mandatory evacuation are Scott River Road from Bridge Flat to the intersection of Highway 96, along with all areas south of Highway 96 between Scott River Road and Girder Creek. An advisory has also been issued for areas north of Highway 96 between Scott River Road and Girder Creek. And as Newswatch 12's Steven Sandberg reports, crews are hoping to get the latest growth under control.
The Falkstein fire made a big run on Wednesday, and now there are mandatory evacuations in place on the Happy Camp complex. The Happy Camp complex is made up of the Frying Pan Fire and the Falkstein Fire. Wednesday, the Falkstein grew by more than 2,000 acres to the east, which prompted the mandatory evacuations. Fire information officers did say that no structures have burned on the complex since it was started by lightning earlier this month. It's been a slow firefight because crews have had a difficult time battling the steep terrain to access the fire, and the flames have had plenty of fuel in the area.
This season alone, since we have an extended drought, what's happening with the trees is they're weakened, and there hasn't been any fire history in this area at all, so it's really thick in there, so walking in and out is difficult. The terrain's really steep.
The thick smoke has also been keeping some helicopters and air tankers from flying over the complex. Hand crews, bulldozers, and aerial attack are all on the fires here in the Happy Camp complex, and crews say their next step is to continue to strengthen the fire lines around both of the major fires. In Happy Camp, Stephen Sandberg, Newswatch 12.
All right, folks, that's Ohio Exopolitics for this Sunday evening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Sorry about the sound problems. We'll be back next week. Have a good evening.